Well, let's go ahead and get started. We're studying the miracles of Jesus, and today is our first class in this study, an introduction. I'm not saying the introduction, because there are many introductions that we could have to the miracles of Jesus. This is the one I've developed for this class. If you would, turn in your Bibles to Mark chapter 4. And we're going to start by reading one of the accounts of one of the miracles. Mark chapter 4, 36 through 41. And leaving the multitude, they took him along with them, just as he was, in the boat. And other boats were with him. And there arose a fierce gale of wind, and the waves were breaking over the boat, so much that the boat was already filling up. And he himself was in the stern asleep on the cushion. And they awoke him and said to him, "Teacher, do you not care that we are perishing?" And being aroused, he rebuked the wind and said to the sea, "Hush, be still." And the wind died down, and it became perfectly calm. And he said to them, "Why are you so timid? How is it that you have no faith?" And they became very much afraid and said to one another, "Who then is this that even the wind and the sea obey him?" Who then is this? This is really the question, isn't it? Who then is this? The answer to this question is the basis for our faith. Every time we walk through these doors, we proclaim our answer to this question. Every time we open the Bible to read it and study it, we proclaim the answer to this question. Every time we are tempted to sin and we say, "No, I'm not going to do that," we proclaim our answer to this question. And those times when we are weak and we give in to the temptation and we say, "Father, forgive me, for I have sinned," we proclaim our answer to this question. Who then is this? As we begin this study of the miracles of Jesus Christ, this is the one thing that I would like for us to keep in mind throughout. Who then is this? This is simply not a study about some wonderful works that Jesus performed during his lifetime on this earth. It is a study about the question of who Jesus is and how our answer to that question should influence every aspect of our lives as Christians. You know, as was the case with the parables, different men are going to be teaching this study. We're all taking turns. I think we have 11. We had 5 Sundays, so we have 9 different teachers. I'm teaching twice in this next month. And I don't have any control over what the men who are teaching teach other than the miracle they've been assigned. But if I could encourage all of us who are teaching to do one thing, it's to remember that that's what this study is about. Who is Jesus Christ? Who then is this that even the wind and the sea obey him? And it's interesting that just a couple of chapters after this miracle in Mark's account, we have another miracle take place on the Sea of Galilee where Jesus sends the disciples off in a boat to the other side of the sea. And in the middle of the night, he comes walking to them on the water. That's actually, if you cannot see that image, that's the image on the screen there. It's a little bit dull. But he comes walking to them on the water. And they're scares them to death. They think it's a ghost. And it says they cried out. But notice what we're told in the text as to why they reacted the way they did. That they had not gained any insight from the incident of the loaves. And I know I mentioned this in the announcements last Sunday morning if you were here. But the point is that they were to gain insight from what happened with the feeding of the 5,000, which happened immediately prior to this. They should have known who it was. And earlier, you know, they really should have known who was in the boat with him. And the thing is that if we're going through the study and we're not gaining the insight we should gain through the miracles Jesus performed and who they demonstrate that he is, then we're not getting what we need to be getting out of this study. So I would just, you know, try to remind us all to focus then that that's what this study is about, the person of Jesus Christ and what all these things, all these miracles he did demonstrate about who he is. Well, just we're going to talk for just a minute about the schedule and what we'll be studying in this class. By my count, Rick Harrington's count, I think I have some folks that agree with me, and when I was reading some of the commentaries, there are 35 miracles that Jesus performed as he walked on this earth. And there's one that he performed after he was raised from the dead. What was the miracle he performed after he was raised from the dead? Anyone know? I know, but didn't. The miraculous catch of fishes when he saw the disciples there on the Sea of Galilee. Another miraculous catch of fishes. So we'll be studying those 36 miracles. But in addition to that, there are some miracles that Jesus himself did not perform as he walked on this earth, but directly pertain to the person of Jesus Christ. And the question we're asking, who then is this? And that's the birth of Christ. These are marked with an asterisk in the schedule, if you had seen them. And this will be the next lesson that Les is teaching. The birth of Christ, the transfiguration, the miracles of the crucifixion, and the miracles of the resurrection. And these all speak to who the person of Jesus Christ is. So I think they're well worth our time studying them. And then one final thing that I think would be good, and actually Anita brought this up, and I thought it was a great idea. Do miracles occur today? That might be a very good way to end this study, because that's a natural question that comes out of a study like this. So if you know, things go according to plan, we could be studying the miracles through the end of July. If we get an evangelist before, you know, we finish, hopefully he will take over or at least help teach this study as well. But and I've left, after the month of March, I have left the dates out, because some of these miracles could easily be two classes. When you think of John 9, the healing of the blind man, there's an entire chat. That's what happens when I go fast. My words get ahead of my brain. There's an entire chapter devoted to that miracle, the raising of Lazarus. There are some other, the lame man at the pool of Bethesda, that easily could require two class periods. And that's going to be up to the discretion of the person teaching. You know, so I don't want to lock them into one class period if I don't have to. So, you know, when I'm trying to get the men to respond quickly so I can know how to do that, I'm having trouble with that, hint, hint. So please, when I send out emails and ask for, you know, what you want to teach on the following month, try to respond quickly, because that will make things a lot easier for me developing the schedule and allow us to maybe say, okay, I'll take two Sundays on that one. And be looking, men who are teaching, be looking over the schedule. Tell me if you want to teach a particular miracle. If you don't tell me, it's going to be assigned to you, and you may not necessarily like the one for teaching anyway that you're assigned. So, but that's the schedule. But there's going to be some things we're not studying. Just a couple things that came to my mind is instances of miraculous knowledge that Jesus demonstrated. Can anyone think of one or two? Les?
I guess the first one that comes to my mind, because perhaps it's the first one in the book of John, where Jesus knew what Nathanael was under the fig tree.
I didn't even think of that one. Yeah. And that's, you know, that's a miracle. Really, Nathanael maybe and Philip were the only ones that were, you know, privy to it. These things are not necessarily things Jesus performed. There are things he did that were certainly miraculous. And there are others we could talk about. Very interesting. And they're certainly worth studying. But these are not miracles he performed. And they were really, really not done publicly, I think, would be the one reason we're probably not going to discuss those. And then I can think of two instances of miraculous escapes. They were, you know, Jesus was in Nazareth. And they were going to throw him over a cliff. And it said he disappeared from their midst, kind of. I think I've got the script, Luke 4:30. And then in John 10:39, they were going to take him by force, but he escaped. Now, that may not have been miraculous, but I think probably, you know, he just sort of disappeared. But those weren't really miracles that Jesus performed. So we're not going to necessarily look at those in this class. Well, let's go ahead and get to the definition of a miracle quickly here. So, and I think maybe one of the better ways to define a miracle is what a miracle is not. We have a lot of expressions that we use in this day and time that might include the word miracle. Can anyone think of any that they... The miracle of birth. Look, Elaine, we're on the same page. The miracle of birth. So I'm really quick with this, I can tell you. People say the miracle of birth. Here's one. I don't know if any of you watch racing. I don't watch it a whole lot anymore. But Ryan Newman in the Daytona 500 was in this horrendous crash. And the car tumbled and caught on fire and everything. And somebody might, it's a miracle he survived. You know, you look at something like that, and that, you know, people make that expression. I have a saying around the office. I said, it's a miracle we ever make any profit. You know, there are days when I don't know how. I don't know how. It's like loaves and fishes. I don't know how we're making money here, but we're making it, you know. We'll get back to this in just a minute. But these, you know, these are common uses of the term miracle that I would say are not miraculous. And we'll talk about that in just a second. Well, what is a miracle? Who wants to define a miracle for us in just a few words? Few words.
Something that goes against the laws of nature.
Something that goes against the law of nature. I have written down here something that is supernatural that could not possibly occur as a result of natural events. That's my definition. Here's Webster's definition number one. Now, Webster's has a number of definitions, but this is number one, which I think applies to what we're studying here. An extraordinary event manifesting divine intervention in human affairs. Birth of a child happens every day. Birth of animals, it's natural. It's the natural course. God does not have to intervene to have a child be born in human affairs. You know, NASCAR, those cars have been, you know, worked on and safety procedures have been in place and they enact new ones every time something happens. It is not a miracle that Ryan Newman survived that crash. It's the result of all this technology and all this safety equipment and all these things that now, did he get hurt a little bit? Did things happen? Could someone die? Yeah, but it's not miraculous. God did not necessarily intervene in that to spare his life. Now, providentially, we don't know the answer. But you cannot call that a miracle. You know, the fact that we make profit sometimes is not a miracle. When we're doing what we're supposed to do, and I quote, the job's right, and the guys actually don't make mistakes, we do pretty well. So, and I don't make mistakes. So, you know, those things, God is not intervening to make those things happen. But there are people that will actually read the Bible and argue that the miracles that Jesus performed can be attributed to natural events. I mean, to me, it is the most ludicrous thing to say in the world. It's puzzling to me how anyone would profess a belief in Jesus Christ and even the eyewitness accounts of the biblical record and then say, well, you know, there's an explanation, the, you know, for walking on the water. It was really shallow that day, you know, right in that area. Or, you know, and the wind was blowing really hard and, you know, things such as that. Or he wasn't really blind, you know, maybe he hit his head or something or something in the water did that. You know, and it's just people will try to explain away these things. We're proceeding under the assumption that we all believe in the Bible here and that we believe that the miracles recorded are true and indeed accurate according to how things happen, that these are not mass hallucinations of people, as some, and I don't understand why people profess that. So that's as much as we're going to entertain that at all. But here's a quote I found from C.S. Lewis that I thought was just fantastic. The question of the possibility of miracles is inseparably connected with the existence of God. If He exists, then miracles are not only possible, but plausible. Certainly then, if Jesus of Nazareth was who he claimed to be, God, we should expect that he performed miracles. And that's exactly what we see, isn't it? That if we believe in God, then we should believe in miracles. I mean, why wouldn't we? It's plausible, probable, really, if you want to think about it. And this is precisely what we find in the biblical record, isn't it? Jesus performing miracles. Now, the Pharisees, they didn't believe in Jesus, but they could not deny that he performed miracles. And we see that a number of times throughout the Gospels. And we'll actually look at a passage or two, or talk about that a little bit more as we go along here. Well, there are four Greek words that are used in the Gospels to characterize miracles. And we've probably heard these before in introductions like this, but they're worth looking at, and I think they teach us a lot about the purpose of miracles and Jesus himself. The first one is dunamis, and it is the same Greek word from which we get our word dynamite. When you think of dynamite, what do you think of other than an explosion?
Power.
And that's basically what dunamis means, power or force. And if I'm not pronouncing it correctly, tough, just, you know, D-U-N-A-M-I-S, so dunamis. But it means power or force. And it's translated miracle or mighty works, depending on what translation of the Bible you use. I believe the ESV translates it mighty works in most cases. Matthew 11, 20 through 21, here's a good example of that. I've highlighted the Greek word dunamis there in the English. Then he began to reproach the cities of which most of his miracles were done, power, force, were done, because they did not repent. Woe to you, Chorazin, woe to you, Bethsaida, for if the miracles had occurred in Tyre and Sidon, which occurred in you, they would have repented long ago in sackcloth and ashes. His power had been demonstrated by these miracles, but the response was not what it should have been, was it? Even though his power was demonstrated, they did not respond to that power the way they should have, the way that Tyre and Sidon would have responded. Did I see a hand or a comment? And I don't have a lot of room for comments. We do have a lot to cover, but feel free to raise your hand and let me ignore you. You know, a lot can be learned about a Greek word by the way it's used in other contexts. And I found this extremely interesting when I was doing some research here on this word. This is Paul speaking about tongues in 1 Corinthians 14 and 11. And here's what he says here. If then I do not know the meaning of the language, I shall be to the one who speaks a barbarian, and the one who speaks will be a barbarian to me. The word meaning there is that Greek word dunamis. Paul's saying, if I don't know the force behind the language, the power, the force behind the word, that's really what he's saying, then it's useless. It's useless if I don't know what's behind it. And I think that's interesting. It's one thing to hear a word or read a word. It's an entirely other thing to understand it, isn't it? I mean, I can read Spanish, and I know some of the words, but some words I don't understand. To those in Chorazin and Bethsaida, the passage we just looked at, they recognized Jesus' power, but refused to recognize the meaning or the force behind it. The Pharisees clearly recognized Jesus performed miracles, but to whom did they attribute them to? Beelzebub, Satan, the devil. They were unwilling to recognize the force or the meaning behind the miracles of Jesus. I think that's really interesting that Greek word is used that way. And notice what Jesus said to them when they were accusing him of that in Luke 11, 20. If I cast out demons by the finger of God, then what you need to recognize is the kingdom of God has come upon you. That the fulfillment of prophecy is here. There is meaning behind what Jesus did. There is power behind it. So that's dunamis. The next one is teres. And this word basically means wonder. And it's translated as such in all the most common literal translations. You get into some of the, like the Living Bible, and they'll use a different word. But wonder, we probably all have a translated wonder in our version. Vines defines it as something strange causing the beholder to marvel. And it's nearly always coupled with another word in the New Testament. Anyone know what that word is? Signs and wonders. Almost, I think, I couldn't find it used in when speaking of miracles. I did not find it in any, you know, it could say they were wondering about something. That's the same Greek word, but that's not necessarily speaking about miracles. So, but it's always coupled with the Greek word. And it's interesting that every time the word wonder is used in the Gospels in relation to miracles, there's a negative connotation behind it. I didn't know that until I was doing this study. And it's only used three times in the Gospels. One of those times is John 4:48. Jesus therefore said to him, unless you people see signs and wonders, you simply will not believe. And I think the point of that is that if we think of miracles simply as dazzling demonstrations of Jesus' power, we're missing the point of them completely. That was not the point of miracles, to be this like a fireworks show. Ooh, ah. Unfortunately, we see these large crowds, thousands upon thousands of people following Jesus because of the wonders. Not necessarily because they saw the force behind them. The most common word that we see in the New Testament, a Greek word, is semion. And this is the word that is translated sign in the most common translations of the New Testament. And this is the word that is the most commonly used to describe miracles in the Bible, or in the New Testament anyway. And the Baker Encyclopedia of the Bible defines it this as a word connoting a visible event intended to convey meaning beyond that which is normally perceived in the outward appearance of the event. We've got a sign out front here. Most of us have probably noticed it. I think it's pretty. It's a picture of a mountain scene, by the way, if you didn't know this. I know some didn't. It's actually a scene from the parking lot of the mountains over here. What's that gap called?
Minehold Gap.
So that's on the sign right there. So do we have that sign out there so people could walk, drive by and stop and say, oh, what a pretty sign. Isn't that beautiful? And then go on their way. Is that the intention of that sign? No, it's to tell them something about who we are that meet in this place. It's to point to something greater than itself. If all they did and stopped and looked at the sign, then it's worthless. But that sign is supposed to point to something greater than itself. And that's what the signs Jesus performed were intended to do. They weren't supposed to be these dazzling displays. They were supposed to point to something greater than themselves. Our sign even has service times posted on it and a website. More information. How often did Jesus perform a miracle and continue to teach and say something and demonstrate verbally as well as physically who he was? Nicodemus got it. Rabbi, we know that you have come from God as a teacher, for no one can do these signs that you do unless God is with him. These signs demonstrated to Nicodemus what? Power. And that God was with Jesus. That God, they pointed to something greater than themselves. That this guy can't do this unless God is with him. But unfortunately, we have statements like this in John 12:37. But though he had performed so many signs before them, yet they were not believing in him. To these people, the signs were wonders. They were just these dazzling displays. Was the problem with the signs themselves? Were they inferior? Was that the problem? What was the problem with the people who didn't believe?
Their hearts.
They had all the evidence they needed, but they didn't believe it. And there may be multiple reasons for that we could talk about. Well, finally, there's one other Greek word used to describe miracles in the Bible, and that's ergon, which means works. And it's used both for Jesus' miracles, but also for ordinary deeds of mercy. For instance, in Matthew 5:16, let your light shine before men in such a way that they may see your good works and glorify your Father who is in heaven. Same Greek word. So is it talking about our miracles? That people are supposed to see our miracles and glorify God? No, but our good works, our kindness, our devotion to God, our sympathy, our compassion, all these things, our love for others. They're supposed to see those and glorify God. And again, it's all pointing to something else, isn't it? That's what we need to keep realizing about all of these things. Here's where it's used in the case of miracles in John 5 and verse 36. Jesus says, but the witness which I have is greater than that of John. John didn't do miracles, I think, is part of the point Jesus is making. For the works which the Father has given me to accomplish, the very works that I do bear witness of me that the Father has sent me. These are what are demonstrating that God has sent me here. These works, ergon. And there's a really neat passage, Acts 2 and verse 22, where dunamis, pteris, and Simeon are all used conjunctively here. Men of Israel, listen to these words. Jesus the Nazarene, a man attested to you by God with miracles. That's the dunamis. Wonders, pteris, and signs, Simeon, which God performed through him in your midst, just as you yourselves know. A man attested to you by God. These signs, these wonders, these miracles all attested that Jesus came from God. And that's what the point Peter's making in Acts chapter 2 and verse 22 there. There are a couple other passages. I think Hebrews 2 uses those three words simultaneously as well. All right, well, we've kind of been getting at this all the way along here is the purpose of Jesus' miracles. And we've kind of touched on this. But just the way these Greek words are used kind of help us understand the purpose, don't they? That it's not about the miracle themselves. It's about what they demonstrate. One thing I thought about, and this is all Rick Harrington. I didn't get this out of a commentary or not. But one thing I think we recognize as we read about the miracles of Jesus is they were not simply performed to draw crowds to himself. And I'd say an argument can be made that the crowds were a necessary, perhaps oftentimes unwanted byproduct of Jesus' miracles. Why might I say that? Why might Jesus have not wanted the crowds at times?
Oftentimes when crowds were drawn, they were not really getting the point of the miracle. You know, they followed them across the Sea of Galilee because they wanted some more food.
Yeah, you seek me, why? Because of the bread. He says the signs, but I think because of I did a sign, you know, and you got bread out of it, so you're seeking me for more bread. You're hungry. And that's what they, they start talking about Moses and the man in the wilderness, you know, hinting, you know, can we get some more of that bread? That's kind of what happens there. It's interesting that that Jesus even, oftentimes, I think I counted about 8 times in the New Testament. It's hard to tell which ones are parallels or not. I didn't take the time to really do that. But where he actually discouraged people from talking about a miracle he performed on them. We have one here, Mark 7:36, where he healed a deaf and dumb man. And he gave them orders, I think those who were standing there witnessing the event, maybe the disciples, not to tell anyone. But the more he ordered them, the more widely they continued to proclaim it. And again, 7 or 8 times, Jesus says, don't tell anybody about this. And I think what Jesus understood is that these multitudes, you know, and all these things that are happening could potentially have led to an early crucifixion. Did things prematurely. In John chapter 6, after the feeding of the 5,000, it appears he intentionally offends the crowd. Have you ever noticed that? Unless you eat my flesh and drink my blood, you know, you cannot be my disciple. I mean, and that is basically everybody left except for just a handful of disciples. He's doing that on purpose. And it said just prior in verse 15 that they were intending to come and make him king by force. And he says, it's time to get rid of these people who are following me just because of the signs of the miracles I'm doing. So the signs are not simply to draw crowds. Now, I think, you know, there's a sense where the more people that followed him, the more they heard the word of God and the teaching. But it turns out that so many, when you think about it, well, I think I'll get that point later on, so I don't want to jump ahead of myself. But even in the case of those who were healed or released from demonic forces, I would suggest that the primary purpose of miracles was not for the sake of the person being healed. Now, Jesus didn't heal people just because they were sick and needed healing. And we'll talk about that in some, for some other reason. But, you know, they always had witnesses. There were always witnesses there. Now, did Jesus have compassion on those who were sick and suffering? Absolutely. But the miracles were not just for the sake of that person, especially their physical well-being. We've got a passage in John 5:14 where this is the lame man at the pool of Bethesda. And it says, afterward, Jesus found him in the temple and said to him, behold, you've become well. Do not sin anymore so that nothing worse may befall you. This man had been 38 years lame, a paralytic. And Jesus is saying there's a lot worse things than being paralyzed for 38 years. You know, and I don't think the point Jesus is making is, well, you know, this happened because you sinned. I don't think that's the point at all. I think the point Jesus is making here, there's something a lot worse than being paralyzed for your life. Don't do anything to jeopardize your eternal soul. And when we think of the miracles, that's what we have to think. The ultimate purpose is for the spiritual well-being of those who follow and learn from Jesus. But those are the two things they didn't do, Rick's words. But they demonstrated that God was with him, just like Nicodemus said in chapter 2 and verse 3 there, I think it was. I might have the verse wrong. But notice what Jesus said in 10:25 in John. I told you, and you do not believe the works that I do in my Father's name. These bear witness of me. They demonstrate that God is with them. They bore witness that he came from God, just like some other passages that we saw. They confirmed that the word he spoke came from God. I mean, I think that just goes without saying, really. We could look at Hebrews 2, another passage. And this is related more to the apostles, but it's true of Jesus as well. And they went out and preached everywhere while the Lord worked with them and confirmed the word by the signs that followed. There was somebody performing miracles, and the disciples came up to Jesus and said, hey, there's somebody over there doing works in your name. Should we stop them? And Jesus said, no, let them alone. How can somebody perform works in my name and then speak evil of me afterwards? And that's really the point, that the miracles themselves show that what Jesus said was true. He had God with him, confirming that everything he was saying and everything he was doing was true. They demonstrated he was the prophesied Messiah, or really proved it. And Matthew 8, 16 through 17 is one passage where we see that he cast out the spirits with the word and healed all who were ill in order that what was spoken through Isaiah the prophet might be fulfilled, saying, he himself took our infirmities and carried away our diseases. So this is part of that Messiah who was coming, that he was going to do these things. And I think there's also a spiritual application here. But the signs that Jesus performed, the healings that he did, were a sign that he was the prophesied Messiah. They proved that he was the Messiah. And ultimately and finally, and I think this is the point that we've been getting at throughout the study, is that so that we may believe it. And this passage is well known to all of us, but if you don't have this highlighted in your Bible, highlight it. Because this really says it all. Many other signs, therefore, Jesus also performed in the presence of the disciples, which are not written in this book. But these have been written, that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you may have life in his name. These are written so that we might believe in him, that he is the Son of God. Who then is this? That even the wind and the sea obey him? It's God himself, the Son of God, Jesus in the flesh. And that we should believe in and have life in his name as a result. Have you ever heard anyone say that well, you know, I'd believe in Jesus if I had just been there to see the miracles he performed. Have you ever heard anybody make that argument? What's the problem with that argument? I can think of two problems with that. Most of the people... Go ahead, Les.
Well, Jesus said at one point that even though, well, this was the case of Lazarus and the rich man, that even though one rose from the dead, they still wouldn't believe.
Yeah.
So the record that we have is a historical record that is easily verifiable. And so the written record is as good as seeing.
Exactly, and that's what John is saying right here. That this is why these things are written down, so that you might believe. When you think about the multitudes, the myriads of thousands, Luke says in one place, that followed Jesus, probably more people that witnessed the miracles actually didn't believe in. Most of the people who witnessed the miracles didn't actually end up believing in him. They were following him for the sign, you know, for the wonders and things. Did you have a comment, Jack?
Yeah.
Zach? Jack? Jack works too.
It also reminds me of Thomas's comment when he didn't believe that Jesus was really risen. And John 20 and verse 29, right before this passage that you have up there, Jesus said to him, "Have you believed because you have seen me? Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed."
And that's what we're supposed to do, isn't it? I mean, that's really the point Jesus makes here. He's given us all the evidence we need to believe in him through the word he's revealed. That's what we have to understand. That's what the study is all about. And it should inspire faith in us. And I don't want to get into too much commentary on some of the miracles we looked at, because I don't want to ruin anybody else's teaching or give, you know, put stuff out there. Quickly, we've got just a few minutes left. I think the first bell is about to ring, but Ken's going to really broaden out the second ring if he needs. No, I'm almost done. Classifications of miracles. This is kind of interesting, and people classify the miracles differently. This is Rick Harrington's classification. But I think there's some interesting things here. First of all, miracles over nature. What are some examples of miracles over nature? Just real quick.
Calming the storm.
Any else? Changing the water into wine, you could even say. Things such as that. What do they demonstrate? Power over what? Nature over
creation.
Well, who has power over creation? The Creator. They demonstrate Jesus' power as the Creator. Go to John 1:1 if you don't know that already. I'm sure all of us do. The Word was with God, and the Word was God. Without him, nothing was made that was made. He is the Creator, and every time he does a miracle over nature, he's demonstrating his power as the Creator. What about miracles over physical infirmities? I mean, you know, we could list all leprosy, blindness, deafness, dumbness, things such as that, dropsy, things like that. Where do physical infirmities come from? God created everything and it was good. What happened?
It's a result of sin.
It's all the consequence and result of sin. So I would make the point that Jesus' power over physical infirmities is actually a demonstration of his power over sin. He's demonstrating his power over sin when he heals somebody of a physical illness, not just that power over the illness. What about miracles over demonic forces? And we're going to have a number of these we're studying. Casting out of demons, things that happen. Who do they demonstrate that Jesus is? What do they demonstrate about his power? Who's his power over?
Satan.
Power over Satan. Himself.
The whole spiritual
realm. Yeah, look at Ephesians. I didn't look at the actual chapter. I should know that. That all jumbles together in my head. But, you know, high above all principalities and powers and dominions and, you know, spiritual forces and, you know, things such as that. He's over all of it. Way high above, it basically says in the modern terminology. And what about miracles over death, where he raised somebody from the dead? Power over death. Power from the curse and release from the curse and sin of death. Power over the curse. These things all demonstrate who Jesus is. All these things, that he has power over all of these elements. Everything. And that's what we should see as we read them and study them. Well, here's some types of Jesus' miracles. This is just some things I thought of. And these are my own definitions, but I think they're accurate. There are direct miracles where Jesus actually directly healed somebody. You know, a lot of times, you know, by word and by touch, be healed. Things such as that. The woman, or always by word and touch. I jumped ahead of myself. And that's usually the way we see miracles occurring, that Jesus isn't directly healing somebody by speaking to them or touching them or even placing his hand on their eyes or something. Then there's indirect miracles. What might I mean by that? If a direct miracle is Jesus intentionally doing something, what might an indirect miracle be?
The woman touching his garment.
Yeah, the woman with the issue of blood. And he perceived power had gone out. And it says a couple times in the Gospels that everybody who touched the fringe of his cloak was healed. He didn't intentionally reach out, but people were being healed indirectly as a result of who he is. Miracles as a result of faith. Many times he will heal somebody, or right before he heals them, he says, "Your faith has made you well." And, you know, and people are like, well, you have to have faith to be healed. Well, there are miracles that happen apart from faith. How many people were risen from the dead that expressed faith in Jesus? There's no faith there. I mean, they're dead. And then you could talk about some others, you know, the centurion servant who's off the... And that kind of goes in hand. Miracles where an agent was used. What do I mean by that? Not a special agent. But what? Yeah, he took his saliva and some dirt and made spittle and healed somebody's eye. You know, put saliva on his finger one time, healed somebody, changing water into wine. Coin in a fish's mouth, I don't know if that's an agent or not. Two agents, if you think about it, in a sense. But those are interesting. You know, can we gather some lessons from them? Yeah, I'll let the people teaching them figure out what those are. But I think there's some really interesting things we learn. And then miracles over distance, where he healed people, wasn't even in their presence. That goes back to miracles apart from faith. Jairus' daughter, the centurion's servant, there might be some others. Jesus' power was not limited by anything. Any of these things. Whether you had faith or no faith, whether you were there, whether you were somewhere else, whether he touched you or you touched him. None of these things were limited. And then there were times when miracles were not performed. Why? Because of unbelief. That's what limited Jesus' power, was people's failure to believe in him. That's when he wouldn't do a miracle. And there are some places where it might, you know, portray that in a way that's a little hard to understand, but we'll talk about this. And finally, there's three other things about me. I know the bell's about to ring. Characteristics of Jesus' miracles. Number one, they are always done in public. What this teaches us is that they were not simply done for the benefit of the person being healed, but also for the witnesses, I think. There was always evidence that something new, supernatural, actually occurred. There was no doubt miracles occurred, even to his greatest critics who didn't believe in him. They could not deny that a notable miracle had been done. And finally, they were never questioned at the time they were performed. Nobody ever said that didn't happen. Not in the scriptures. People question them now because they don't want to believe in them. Now that's the problem. Jesus chastised those who demanded signs of him for their unbelief and lack of faith. Let us not be those people. But we have it written so we might believe. So the rest is up to the men teaching the class. But I'm excited about this study, and it's just very interesting and faith-building things we can be looking at. And the men and I have had some discussions, or at least some correspondence, about some other things we could talk about. Thank you so much for your attention.